died, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Name God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
Nice to have you back with us. Maybe you're listening in for the first time. Nonetheless, welcome to you all. This is Henrik. RedIceCreations.com is our website, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We have Rudy Matsoki with us for 1 hour today. He is best known as a medical device and biotechnology entrepreneur, inventor, and angel investor with a history of starting new technology ventures throughout the US and Europe. He's had the opportunity to see some of the newest innovations in healthcare and worked with acclaimed researchers, scientists, and physicians in the orthodox medical industry. He has authored more than 50 patents. He has helped pioneer new companies involved in cardiology, oncology, orthopedics, neurosurgery, and even embryonic stem cell development. Combining these experiences, he wrote a medical thriller series based on true events, now referred to as the Equity Series. We'll discuss his story today, beginning with the controversial use of embryonic stem cells, aborted fetuses, and fetal material. Rudy talks about human trafficking and assassinations to supply the black market of human organ transplants. All right, welcome everybody. We are talking with Rudy Matsoki. This is going to be a very interesting conversation. First of all, Rudy, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm very new to your work, to be frank. We got a guest request by one of our listeners to have you with us. And usually we don't cover fiction books, but this is such a different scenario here since your books are written as fiction, but actually based on your own work experience that you had when you worked in a human genetics lab. And I also want to just mention this idea that although the DNA and the genomics industry is one of the biggest in the world today, one of the biggest in the world, we don't hear too much about it, frankly. So this is a rare opportunity, if you will, to kind of peek inside a little bit. And I'm very interested, Rudy, to hear more about what you write about in Equity of Evil, and especially then about the multi-billion dollar black market of human organ transplants. So tell us how this began for you and how you got involved in all this, Rudy.
Yes, again, it was this novel, which is fiction. It's a thriller, a medical thriller based on true events. And it started during my early in my career. I was a pre-med student at the University of Pittsburgh, and worked then, this probably dates me a little bit, but back in 1977. And to supplement my income to help support my schooling, I took a job in human genetics engineering as a pre-med student. And my task was to basically explore a new genetic defect at the time. It's called a hydatidiform molar pregnancy. And what occurs is that for some unknown reason at the time, the fetus in a pregnant woman would die and be reabsorbed into the uterus of the mother and cause uterine cancer. So we were actually looking for a biomarker or a genetic marker of this defect. So my job early in the morning at 5 a.m., I'd walk to a local university hospital and basically explore a box of aborted fetuses from the clinic that came from the day before. And it was to sort through, to look for physical signs of this defect, which basically was related to the placenta of the aborted fetus. And it was a relatively rare defect at the time, so I might be able to find three or four out of a, you know, a box of 40 to 50 aborted fetuses over the course of a week or two. So we had all this material, and working in a genetics lab, as I was at the time, my secondary task was to do a mini autopsy of sorts on these aborted fetuses and harvest their brain, heart, liver, spleen, lungs, and kidneys, and basically grow them into in a petri dish. So grow the cell cultures, and these cells would grow very, very rapidly, and then we'd do a collection that sort of collect them over a period of week, 1 or 2 weeks, take the single layer of cells and concentrate them down into a pellet, if you will. And the cells, especially if I use the heart, for example, the surface technology, the surface recognition chemistry on the cell surface would allow these cells to re-adhere and reform a natural heart. So we took sheet layers of cells, put them into a pellet, suspended them into a liquid nutrient bath, and they were sort of hanging from the lids of these petri dishes like stalactites from inside of a cave.
Wow.
And we would actually physically grow these organs over a period of months, weeks or months. And the problem we had back then was we didn't have the ability to infuse the nutrients in the center of the organ. We can feed them from the outer surface, but we couldn't feed them from inside like natural blood vessels would. So they would eventually die from the inside out. So that was the beginning, and that was when we pioneered what we called organ cultures back then. And that sort of kicked off my interest in not only genetics, but I'd say medicine in general as a freshman in college.
Okay. Is there any one else you can mention that you worked for? I mean, I guess that there must have been private companies involved in funding some of this research because they wanted to develop this in a later stage, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So what I went on to do is, you know, I finished my college degree and I had to make a choice whether to go on to medicine and, you know, to study medicine, become an MD, or go into graduate studies, which I did at UCLA. So I went to UCLA. I studied in mathematical sciences and biophysics, and ironically had another opportunity to work in another human genetics lab. And there we were looking at the treatment of inherited metabolic diseases, which caused mental retardation. I then went on to being sort of plucked out of academia, if you will, into industry and became a startup CEO or an entrepreneur of several, you know, medical device, biomedical, and biotechnology companies. I think I recently founded my 13th company.
Oh, wow.
So most of the technology that I developed in the last, let's say, 25 to 28 years were more device-oriented products, but I also was one of the original co-founders of the first embryonic stem cell company in the United States, which was back in 2000. And we became one of the, I think there were 9 stem cell approved lines to do research by our President Bush back then. But it was very, very controversial, as you can imagine. We were using the IVF, the in vitro fertilized embryos, which became a big political and moral and ethical issue here in the United States. We had a difficult time financing these companies. Most of the companies I'm involved with are venture-backed, you know, venture capital or private equity. We had a very difficult time raising sufficient capital to move that embryonic stem cell company forward with the intention of treating Parkinson's disease. You know, these were taking embryonic cells and basically morphing them into brain cells that would produce dopamine to treat Parkinson's. Hold a lot of promise, but as you know, there was so much controversy. We ended up selling that company to a publicly traded company in Adelaide, Australia, and it's still a going concern. And I think we're, unfortunately, because of our political arena here in the U.S., we're slipping behind in that arena. So it's been a very interesting career, which, again, I've been privileged to look at new technologies that are sometimes 8, 10, 12 years away of being utilized in man. And that's where my story ideas come from to produce these novels.
So tell us a little bit more, I guess, where the line is drawn between fiction and reality here, then both pertaining to your books and what you do in reality. And I guess I'm also very interested in where overall this research is led today. Most of this, you know, is stuff that happened along, you know, we say what, 30 some years ago or something like that, when you were doing right. it as a student. And that's a pretty long time ago now, considering how quickly this moves. So how much up to speed are you with what's going on today in this field, Rudy?
Well, it's I've gotten a little bit away from it, but it hasn't, again, in our country, it hasn't evolved. And as you may have read or have seen, there's a longstanding debate over a decade, I believe, between the benefits, features and benefits, and pros and cons of using stem cells versus adult cell lines. Well, for example, I've seen tremendous breakthroughs. For example, in Switzerland, there's a university where they were actually taking a digital image of a newborn child's heart valve and creating a three-dimensional skeletal structure, like a framework, and then taking the child's bone marrow stem cells, seeding that structure, and then allowing that to sort of incubate in a chamber, and eventually that valve would replicate itself using the natural tissue of the donor, the patient themselves. And then they would take that valve and implant it in the heart of the patient, and it would grow with the patient. So the big problem in pediatric heart valves is a child that needs a heart valve at 1 or 2 years of age or 3 years of age has to undergo multiple surgeries because the artificial valve does not grow with them as they grow. But this was a way of recreating the natural valve and using the child's own stem cell line to create a new valve that grew with throughout the life of that patient. So it's evolving, but I can't say that it's moving that quickly in the United States. And it might be under wraps, it might be behind closed doors, but we're not seeing it here. I'm seeing a lot more happening, even on the cloning side. We know there's a lot of, and that was one thing that we looked at with the company that we founded. We were actually cloning stem cells, which was that's a long explanation to get into. But we now know that that's becoming a standard practice in countries like Singapore and UK and Australia and other places.
Well, that's right. I remember that too, back in when George W. Bush got in and he allowed this type of research in, which was kind of a, considering his, you know, officially, at least, his stance religious-wise and being conservative and everything, that this usually research went out to other countries, but now there was an opportunity to do this in America. And this has reverted back now, you say? So this is no longer encouraged, is that correct?
That's correct. No, it's very difficult to use in vitro fertilized embryos to do embryonic stem cell work. And I know very few, again, I've gotten away from it with my device sort of orientation, but there's very few, if any, that are practicing using embryonic stem cells here in the U.S. It's all adult cells.
So I mean, this is a very, well, it's gruesome. There's a lot of difficult things here that we're talking about: human organ harvest, embryonic stem cells, working with aborted fetuses. And I mean, is this good? Is this bad? If there is a moral dilemma here at the same time, then that medical science is trying to advance and also then at the same time help other people. Where do you stand on this question then?
No, that's an excellent point. I mean, that's where, you know, I struggled, and I think we did a nice job of it with Equity of Evil, which touches on this entire theme. I tried to be as neutral as possible, and really for the goal of letting people know that, you know, this is happening if we like it or not. I mean, just like the, you know, in the last election we had here in the United States, there was a debate whether or not if the Republican Party was going to get into office, that they were going to overturn Roe versus Wade and make abortion illegal in this country again. So it's like, be careful what you ask for. I mean, abortion is probably one of the most prevalent procedures done in the world today. And there's a very, very high percentage, over 40% of the women, at least in our country here, have had an abortion over the age of 45. So we're not going to eliminate things like abortion. So we got to think about, how do we really want to deal with it? I mean, these are political, moral, and ethical issues that we have to confront. And as science continues to change and brings and maybe taps into things like abortion and utilization of stem cells, or fetal organs, how are we as a society or our governments going to deal with it? And that was the intent behind my book. I'm really forcing the reader to think about it and ask questions. I'm not trying to give guidance. And it's been interesting, the praise that I've gotten on this book, and it's won now 3 or 4 literary awards, but I'm getting praise from both sides of pro-choice and pro-life. So it's kind of ironic. I'll get an email from a Catholic priest that praises me for the courage of writing such a book. And then the next email will be from someone that is pro-choice, and they're claiming victory because of my book. So it's very interesting how people interpret it. And so that was a deliberate act on my behalf. I wanted to go right down the middle the best I could.
Interesting. Now, let's talk about the book here and the outline there. I want to, again, drag it back to reality and see where we're at here. The character in the book, Roman Citrano, is that how you pronounce his
name? Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. He starts up, you know, companies just as you, you know, said that yourself are doing, of course. And he also realized that at some point here that he basically is a pawn on a massive chessboard of sorts being manipulated to benefit a bigger illicit market where you know, where human organs for transplant is the question here. So how close to this is it to reality? Did you encounter any of this? And let's get into this, the dark side of this, if you will.
Yes, yeah, that's good. Because, obviously Roman Citrano is sort of designed after myself. We had the same pedigree, the same academic background. I've been a startup CEO, like I said, as 13 companies. I've been in venture capital. The true elements, obviously, where I pull on the true events was, you know, what I described in that clinic back in 1977, doing autopsies and culturing fetal organs. That's all true. My evolution into the medical sciences and medical device arena, and then getting into venture capital, is true. The other thing that is true to life is that I did have an opportunity as a venture capital investor to review a business plan that was submitted to me based on the utilization of mobile abortion units. So, and that's one of the themes in Equity of Evil, that there's a, you know, Roman Citrano as a venture capitalist is approached by a scientist that came up with the concept of having mobile abortion units. And the idea is just like these, you know, big X-ray or MRI rolling vans or blood mobile vans, that you can instill maybe 3 different surgical suites into a mobile van and go into, I use certain, seedy cities within the United States as an example, and 1 or 2 in Turkey, where they don't have the opportunity. They're underprivileged people. They can't afford to do a proper abortion, or they're going to a, you know, back alley abortion or a self abortion. And this business concept was designed to get, you know, to give them an ability to have a, you know, high quality procedure done at little to no cost. But so I obviously, in my real life, I rejected that plan for obvious reasons. But in the book, Roman is in a position where he needs to take on a deal like this. It doesn't require a lot of capital, and he takes the chance on rolling something like this out. And then the scientist involved has developed a technique to preserve the aborted fetuses, to keep them intact. They're not like the macerated fetuses that you see pictures of by the pro-life people, or, you know, in any magazine or article. Mm-hmm. So they preserve the fetuses. They ship them off to a plant or a factory in India, which basically does what I did back in the 70s, and extracted their organs and grew them like hydroponic vegetables. And then they fed them into the black market. So the black market is truly exists for the organ, for organ transplants, as you can read through, and even in the internet. A lot of it, people are in desperate situations where they need to sell a kidney or something for money. But there's a large market out there revolving around human trafficking, which I touch on in the book as well. I use in a couple examples of women that were pulled out of the sex slave industry and then used basically for experimentation or for their organs.
Incredible. There are people tracking this in the United States and other countries around the world. This is happening, illegal sale of human organs, basically, and we have people posing as, you know, medical doctors in some places, and they need, you know, there are people interested in buying, you know, kidneys or, you know, other things as well. And there is a black market with this linked to it. We have, you know, gangsters and everything involved in, you know, trying to get this out of people. And it's truly, truly horrendous. How much of this did you encounter then in your real work?
Well, I was approached by several organizations about some of my work, which led me to believe that there's this kind of organization that is interested in sort of cultivating organs for a market. But there's also something that I touched on in it, and I have to be a little bit careful because it was an interview of a patient. I read about in the World Health Organization, they actually had a conference, which I mentioned in the book, talking about higher assassinations that were done strictly to get to certain organs. So there was an individual that I actually interviewed here in the States who needed a heart transplant and had very severe steroid use. He was a bodybuilder, destroyed his other organs as well. So they took him off the heart transplant list. And out of desperation, he ended up financing the procurement, I put it in the right way, a procurement of a 22-year-old heart from a male from Italy. And that it was just so happened that their tissue types were in sync. The patient, unfortunately, that victim, I'll call that as a victim, was at the wrong place at the wrong time. And it was ruled as an accident, but it came out later that it was an assassination. And this person basically here in the U.S. got his heart for about $100,000.
Oh, wow.
So it's happening. You know, that's N of one. I don't know how frequent that is, we know it's happening, it's true, and it's something, like I said, even the World Health Organization has addressed in some of their symposiums.
It's a very difficult problem, and it's one that I believe also arises because many of these things are illegal. It's very difficult to compare like this. It's because it's two very, very different things, but take the war on drugs, for example. Mm-hmm. You have and many problems that arise because of the fact that it is illegal. You know, this drives up the prices. This is creates a whole, you know, underworld of you know, shipping this back and forth. And you know, at this stage, even there are many articles that come out that even, you know, governments and things like that is involved in this as well, because there's just so much money in it. But this is not something you simply can make legal, though, Rudy, to get away of the problem. So is it advancement in science forward that's going to solve this in some way, or what is the, how do we fix some of this, if you will?
Well, I think there's other ways. I mean, you come back to stem cells again, and you may have read about some of the breakthroughs where they're using your own stem cells from bone marrow or from your blood, in which they can concentrate them and reinject them into different organs. So there's a way right now that they can harvest your own stem cells to repair your own heart. So I think that's a way to, you know, the scenario I just gave you with, the person needing a heart transplant and basically paying for an assassination to get someone else's heart. That's the extreme, obviously.
Yeah.
But if you can repair his heart using his own adult stem cells, that's the solution. I don't know what the solution is in regards to, you know, the abortion issue. Because, let me step back a minute. There is something that's going to be happening there. There's laws now that are changing that governs the use of that fetal material, obviously. So I think there's ways of prohibiting what I've described in my book. But also, it's not going to go away. Like I said, abortion is not going to go away. We have to deal with it in many ways. If it's educational, we don't need to get on that podium right now, but there's ways of addressing in dealing with abortion, but it's not going to go away in our lifetime.
Do you think research should be done on the fetuses, and is that morally okay in your opinion?
Well, yeah, here's that fine line. We'll walk it for a second. I personally think it is, because at that point, and that's how I rationalized it as an 18-year-old young man back then, was that it was beyond my control. These aborted fetuses were sitting in, you know, Ziploc bags in a large box, not because of anything I can do or anything I can prevent. It was done, and now it was a matter of, do we utilize this tissue and learn from it and possibly treat others because of some of the outcomes that we might learn, or simply discard or incinerate them, which is going to happen regardless if I open that box or not. So that's just a, you know, it's sort of a scientific perspective, you know, that there's no personal gain. Now, if you are selling those organs or selling the fetuses for personal gain, then I have there's a bigger issue there. But to do it for scientific or for, you know, for the benefit of some other development of a technology or a treatment, I would continue to use those materials rather than incinerate or discard them.
Do you think there are scenarios today where, let's say, the doctor will, you know, say to the woman having the abortion that, you know, nothing will happen to the fetus, you know, we'll discard of it in the quote-unquote proper way, but in actuality, they might sell it or they end up doing research on it themselves? Do you think that's something that occurs?
I think it does. There's ways of controlling it. Like I even mentioned that in the back of my book when I talk about some of the facts. And what happened in the storyline with Roman Citrano was that he was sort of duped by the scientist. And there's a form that they had the patient sign. And they informed the mother that rather than saying that the fetus would be or the aborted material would be discarded, they basically changed the wording and said it would be properly dealt with. So there was some wiggle room, if you will, in the language. So, you know, I think that's always something we always got to read the fine print, but I'm sure that is happening with tissue that's taken from patients today. You got to read the fine print because I'm sure there's physicians that are going to put that to work.
Now, there are always issues, health issues that seems to arise, you know, like a lightning bolt from a clear sky, of course, and this is something that perhaps has nothing to do with the choices that the person has done, but tied into this discussion is also a problem that some people think that they can basically buy themselves out of anything, problems that they ultimately have caused themselves because of their, you know, lifestyle or something like that else. So who's buying these organs?
Well, that's a bigger question. I mean, we're looking at something now evolving in our society called medical tourism, which you may be aware of.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat unjust, if you will. I mean, because of our regulatory environment here in the United States, I see a lot of technology that becomes approved in Europe, for example, with CE mark approval, that will become approved 3, 4, 5 years before the U.S. ever starts even clinical trials or clinical studies. So there's people taking advantage of that. There are companies in Europe which will, you know, they'll advertise the procedure or this therapy to U.S. individuals that have the ability to pay. So, for example, if I wanted a new, you know, percutaneous heart valve 2 years ago in this country, I could not get it done. This is basically putting a new heart valve in a beating heart. Normally, I'd have to go through open heart surgery. I'd have to be put on a heart-lung bypass machine. But in Europe, they've developed and received approval on a catheterization technique, almost like doing a coronary stent or an angioplasty, and allows the placement of a new heart valve in a beating heart while you're sitting on a table in a cath lab, wide awake and talking to your surgeon. So 2 years ago, that wasn't here in the United States. If I wanted a heart valve that way, I can pay $300,000-$400,000, be flown over to a beautiful facility in Austria or Switzerland or somewhere, Sweden if you like, and basically have first class treatment, get my procedure done. I can probably spend 2 or 3 days at the spa, do a little sightseeing, and they'll pick me up in a limo and take me to the airport and fly me back home. So there is exploitation and there's a lot of greed in the medical society, but a lot of it's driven indirectly by things like regulatory controls outside in other countries or even legal issues. What's tearing apart our country here is, you know, medical malpractice is got everyone concerned about how you label even a product or a pharmaceutical. So therefore the requirements to go through our FDA is no longer 3 or 4 years, it's 8, 10, 11 years because of the fear of being sued. The physician's afraid of it, the FDA's afraid, the developers are afraid, the manufacturers are scared. So it's really changed our environment over the last 2 decades here.
Indeed. There are, you know, if we look at this from another perspective, a bigger one perhaps, there are some that suggest that the whole medical industry, that the science as a whole needs to be revised. I mean, doctors and other researchers alike that we've had on the program talking about this advocate that people basically starts doctoring themselves. And you know, there's people like Weston Price and many others who advocate that nutrition, you know, food, vitamins, exercise, all of that has to do with one's health. And so this is not only then a discussion about what the medical industry is doing and all that, it's about personal responsibility and taking an interest in, you know, what, how you treat your body, basically, right?
That's right. No, that, and the internet's changing that for all of us. You have websites like WebMD and there's multiple sites that patients can go to and educate themselves. I talked to a patient the other day that had severe problems and probably needed a new knee replacement. And she said that, listen, she was only 40 years old. She didn't want to have knee surgery. And she researched different opportunities and talked about stem cells. They actually harvested some of her own stem cells from her blood and injected them over a series of therapies into her knee. And it sort of reconstituted and rebuilt ligaments in her knee. And today she's probably good for another 15, 20 years before she needs any surgery. So that was patient, you know, individual driven. She could have gone under the knife without blinking an eye and, you know, 2 days later, but she opted to look at more of a holistic or self-treating therapy.
Yeah. I believe that's so. I happened to be at a TV the one of these days. I was traveling and I saw there was some special on CNN or whatever, and they were talking about reformation of the medical system in America and all that, and it was very, very serious, you know, documentary or whatnot. But I heard nothing in there. I didn't see the whole thing, granted, but what I heard was fairly long, and they talked nothing about nutrition or vitamins or food or, yeah, you know, things like that. And I'm just amazed by that they're all looking at research and basically just pouring more money down the hole and more, you know, funding and grants. And I mean, will money solve it? You know?
Yeah. Well, there's just like, you know, I'm now in ophthalmology, which is the, you know, treatment of the eye. And 3 or 5 years ago, there was nothing available for as vitamins for the eye. So I think there's neutral pharmaceuticals now that are going to help our vision, for example. As we get, I mean, we're going to grow to be an older age now. As you know, we've evolved our, you know, man used to live only to be in their 40s, and then it was 60s and then 70s. Now we're looking at the Japanese culture. I think the average life expectancy of a woman is now 93 years of age. So we got to start thinking about other things that are going to start failing in our body, just like natural vision. I mean, obviously taking care of our brain. Our brain is going to be the key. Some people don't care what they're going to look like as long as they have their faculties about them. But you want to have a level of a certain quality of life. So you need the basic elements, right? You need good mental stability, you need good, you know, solid vision, hearing, speech, you want to communicate well. So we're going to look at the fundamentals, and I think just as you touched on, there's other ways to get there through nutrition and supplements and other, you know, physical activity.
I wanted to ask you where you think that this also might lead in the long term. Are you aware of the field of transhumanism, for example?
No, not very much at all.
Basically, the idea of with utilizing technology for most part, but it also ties into medical science and everything else to, you know, transform the human body to be both able to, you know, extend your life, longevity, you know, gerontology research and all this kind of stuff. There are people looking into that. And then at the same time, people are looking into, you know, uploading people's consciousness into computers and things like that. And there's also this very interesting, you know, discussion that comes along with those possibilities. If that ever will happen, we don't know. But, I mean, there are serious scientists and researchers out there looking into it. But that would basically mean that we live longer and longer and longer and we're becoming more and more people on the planet at the same time. Do you think that there's anybody out there thinking about the long term of all of this? Are we meant to live, you know, forever, if you know what I mean, Rudy?
Well, that's a good point. You know, interesting you bring that up. My second novel that's going to be actually it's coming out next week. It's called Equity of Fear. And it talks a great deal about neuroplasticity. And it's the rewiring of the brain. And ironically, you touched on a subject there. We actually are looking into, and this is outside of my writing of fiction, the possibility of uploading memory on a implantable microchip. So, as you may know, they've done functional mapping of the brain. We know pretty much about where functional areas are in the brain for even things like memory. So, and if you break down the activity of the brain, I mean, it's very similar, it's very comparable to a computer. And if you place a microchip with a receiving coil, very in the proximity or in the dural matter of the brain is responsible for memory, you theoretically can capture the electrochemical signals and bring them into a memory chip on that little implantable device, use an algorithm to reconstitute those electrochemical signals into memory, store it, and perhaps manipulate it, if you like, and store it long enough to give it back to that patient when they're 80, 90, 100 years old to restore their memory. So there's, and that's not that far away. I mean, we have the technology, as you may know. My day job right now is a CEO of a company that's developing an electronic autofocusing implantable lens, and that's for the replacement of, you know, cataracts. Mm-hmm. Now that lens itself also has the ability, we can send, receive, and store data on that lens, and we're designing features into it. It'll communicate with other biosensors in the body. So I'm trying to take a real medical approach to it, because we can pick, you know, literally at the blink of an eye, you can blink your eye to send a holographic digital image about 50 centimeters in front of you, and it'll give you a digital readout of your blood glucose level if you're diabetic, or your blood pressure readings, or if you have glaucoma, it'll give you the intraocular pressure readings inside your eye. So that's all under development. I mean, it's years away. And right behind that is that chip, microchip technology I mentioned for capturing and restoring and manipulating memory.
And soon enough, it will be Google Vision, and it will augment reality. And as you walk past a restaurant, you can read reviews of the restaurant right there in your retina as you walk past.
That's right. Or you think, you've heard about facial recognition software.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, what if we built that into the lens inside your eye? So you walk by someone in the street, you get a facial recognition and with another blink of an eye, or you look down at your iPhone or your smartphone, and it'll give you that person's bio and how you know them, or how you may know some of their relatives or neighbors.
See, that's really creepy to me.
Creepy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've been looking into transhumanism, you know, for a long time, and what I've noticed as well at the same time, and I mean, it seems to be, Rudy, and I want to open up the discussion a little more here to some of the other possibilities or potential downsides to this, and it's basically like, if you don't use a muscle in the body, it atrophies, and I'm thinking about, is it going to be the same thing as memory? Although these are devices and things like that that are supposed to help us with our memory, the less we use those functions, the more they will disappear. So as we adopt this technology, we also become incredibly dependent on it. And if something fails, if that breaks down, if we extend it long enough into the future, where mankind might be so dependent on these technologies that if it fails, everything will collapse and fall apart right there.
You're absolutely right. No, you're a very, very bright comment, because there, if you look at the internet again, there's websites like Luminosity, which basically is designed to exercise your brain. And that's the essence of neuroplasticity. Our brain is just that. It's more plastic than we realize. We can manipulate, train, and retrain our brain. So actually one of the companies I was involved in was called NovaVision, and it was a photic neurostimulation therapy to restore vision in blind people. And what we were doing was basically using a light energy going through the eye. You know, the eye is just a conduit to the brain. It's a part of the brain. It's a conduit to the visual cortex in the back of the brain. These patients were blind from stroke or traumatic brain injury. And what we did was we identified the area of sort of blindness in the adjacent healthy area. And we would bombard that area, the healthy area, or the borderline between the two, with this photic energy, light energy, repeatedly over 3, 4, 5 months, and basically exercise the brain to to the point where the healthy area took up the visual processing of the blind area.
Hmm.
So we were restoring 70, 80, 90% of vision in these blind people. It's phenomenal.
Interesting. So you can, in effect, you can bring it back to life. And this was kind of a laser. What kind of light was this?
Very simple photic light. It were just little orbs or strobes of light that mm-hmm. were emanated from a head-mounted display, almost like a virtual gaming display. So, but because that's all it took. I mean, the eye wasn't perceiving these little photic spots of light, but the brain was. So even though the blind area couldn't see anything, there was an area, and we did functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, to prove that that area was very active, and it was basically learning. We were retraining that area of the brain to see. So and that's why these games, you know, luminosity in these games, even patients, I encourage, you know, my elderly parents and grandparents to keep doing crossword puzzles, Sudoku. Those are brain exercises, and we need to continue to do that. The generation before us did not do that. Even games, when I watch children play video games, they're getting enormous stimulus into their brain. Now, if we'd started doing that at 70, 80, 90 years old, I think that would be a good thing for our brain. It would keep us young.
Computer games?
Absolutely.
Hmm.
Any stimulus like that will just keep those neurons firing, and that's how you retain structure and you retain those electrochemical elements that are they're key for even memory.
Well, that's interesting. I've also heard the reverse of that, that if you if there's too much excitement, if you will, in the brain and activity all the time, it can also lead to other problems. You know, there's new symptoms popping up, like ADD and all these things. And there's a lot of question, of course, where this is, what this really is, the source of where it's coming from, and all that. But I notice a tremendous, well, I guess speed as well, people have said, in comparison to teenage TV and MTV and everything else, in terms of how fast everything is cut. It's like their clock cycle of the brain is just on a higher level, and it's incredibly active and like it's like electricity, and I can't watch it, so I get a headache seeing it.
Well, but I think I've always been told and educated to the point where we don't really use a big portion of our brain. I mean, when I was a pre-med student, I think it was 8 or 9% of our brain we actually utilize. So I don't know, just personal opinion, I think the more we can keep it active and more we stimulate it, the better off we are.
Interesting. Now, tell us a little bit more about Equity of Fear, or if there's something else we left out of in Equity of Evil, if kind of where this goes in the maze, if you will, of the character that he goes, and also we were very interested in hear how this dovetails, I guess, with reality and what you've seen, Rudy.
Yeah, so, well, because of, Equity of Evil was easy for me to write because it was based on a lot of my own personal life and experiences. Because of its success, I have a literary agent and a publisher that asked if I can create a sort of an equity series. So I'm looking at writing a series of three novels. The second one is Equity of Fear. And Roman Cetrano does not play a lead role in this one, but he's a supporting character, if you will. So there's some continuity. It's not a sequel, if you will. But it touches on the same issues. It's about medical science that we have not seen yet, but is under development, and the business elements and political issues that surround that new medical science. So just as I described, this is based on neuroplasticity, and there's a company that in my novel that develops something similar to, as I mentioned, to stimulating the brain to see again, but they have a way of eliminating fear. And it's like the fear of flying, the fear of insects, the fear of darkness. And it's basically retraining the brain on how to process it. And the story starts, just as a quick example, it starts with a woman who has a fear of flying. And she wears a visual display unit over her eyes, like a gaming virtual reality display. And she has an accelerant injected into her bloodstream, and it opens up a pathway to a specific area of the brain. And now through this photic display, we can introduce little very, very quick digital images. So in her brain, she's seeing digital images of you know, flying in first class, drinking champagne with her husband holding her hand next to her, greeting her family members at the gate. And this is just a retraining over and over, you know, several therapy units, procedures, to the point where we've totally eliminated her fear of flying. So if you can take that a few steps further down the path and think about how, what happens if you can give this therapy to a soldier, for example, a warrior, and eliminate his fear of pain or fear of death. So, and that leads into my third novel, which is going to be based on another controversial topic, euthanasia, and which we're just doing research on that now. But so you can imagine the you know, what would countries and governments and societies do, or what would you pay for if you had a mother or father that had Alzheimer's disease and lost their memory? And we had the ability to put them through a series of therapy to reinstill or restore their memories. So we can take that many different ways, but you know, that's where the story Equity of Fear gets into. And there's a very dark and seedy world that we created in this book, in which I experiment and torture, and it relates to torture and pain, and what people would go to at lengths to control that ability.
Well, you know, I don't think it's too far off from reality. I mean, you mentioned this thing about memory and controlling fear and everything else. I mean, I know that Pentagon, probably through DARPA and some of the other agencies there, they're trying to basically develop a pill and other things to control, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome and things like that. Even memory and again, it's that borderline, you know, that there is a, I mean, those are responses to natural things for a reason, I believe. Are we meant to remove those processes that causes people to, I guess, morally object to something, to turn them effectively into robots? You know, it might sound sci-fi, but if you think about it, if you take away, in effect, kind of lobotomize those areas of the brain that gives you the stress and things that are involved with the actions that you're, you know, part of, does that leave us, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think fear is not a bad thing. I think it makes us react differently. It makes us maybe cautious in certain times. I think, you know, we learn from fear, but it's also something that we learn from. You know, when I look at a child, when does a child fear a fire? It's after they burn themselves the first time. So those things that we learn, I think, are very important to maintain. But again, if you think of in war times, if you can have a professional soldier that has no fear, that becomes, you know, actually we call it the kamikaze project in the book.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, and if you look at the world, the sad world we live in with, you know, these suicide bombers and things, I mean, this is, it becomes a very scary, crazy world when you think about what you can do if you rewire the brain. And, you know, and what I emphasize is just view our brains like our laptop computer. You know, you pull it out of the box and it's fresh and ready to go like it is when we're young and newborn. And it can be trained and reprogrammed, and you can upload and download things. And I always hated that expression, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, I think you can. I think our brain, when we're 80, 90 years old, I think we're eventually going to be able to rewire it and teach it new things.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up in terms of, you know, suicide bombers and all that too, because, I mean, religion has effectively been rewiring the brain for, you know, centuries successfully with, you know, propaganda, manipulation. And I think that the microchip and the pill are just the latest incarnation in that same, you know, scientific development, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's we can go off on a big tangent here, but one of my favorite authors was Eric Hoffer, who wrote The True Believer, and he did a study of some of our the biggest, I won't say good or bad, leaders of the world, you know, like even, you know, John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and I don't want to put them in the same category, but Adolf Hitler, and how they manipulated people by playing off of three major components. And it's interesting, if you look at their speeches and how they presented themselves in the public, they always spoke and included words that were key people that were visual, or people that were more auditory, or people that had some dexterous feel. So there's many elements of the brain that you can appeal to, even through propaganda and speech.
Yeah.
And change the way people view the world.
Oh, sure. Oh, definitely. It's happening every day in very subtle ways and in very obvious ways as well. So I agree. Now, there's also, again, if we go back to this, you know, the idea of the development of the human body, both through medical science and maybe with the aid of technology and everything else, other concerns that have been raised about this is that there might be taken a tremendous leap forward by those who have the means to do it. Either that means those who are researching it, or those who have the, let's say, the money to pay for it, or you know, just the I guess at the time they dare to do it. So in a way, they're pioneers, right? They're explorers. But updating their body, their properties, hooking up the brain to the you know, worldwide mind, effectively the brain computer interfaces, so that it can actually, you know, calculate faster, they can search for answers quicker, et cetera, do you think that this could cause a schism, if you will, in society, a rift between people, like those who have it and those who don't? I mean, this might sound like sci-fi, Rudy, but I mean, as we've been talking about here, a lot of sci-fi stuff is actually, you know, becoming reality.
That's the point that I try to make in the book. These are all true medical sciences that are under development, and we can spend another hour talking about some other ones that will scare you even more. But what I worry about as an individual, and this is a personal opinion more than anything, is that the way things are regulated and controlled, you know, the requirements that we even have to go to as we develop an implantable medical device takes 8-10 years to get done. And there's such a level of control by different governments in what we call notified bodies and regulatory bodies, legal issues. I worry about the ability for us as individuals to control the utilization of that technology and have it be under the control of, this sounds old school, but governments, you know, Big Brother. That's what I get to in, you know, in Equity of Fear, that this never reaches the main populace of the world. It's controlled by governments and for their own purposes, you know, to build a military machine, or, you know, to manipulate people, you know, like you said, propaganda. You know, there's going to be a time, and you know what, you know, about subliminal advertising. You know, it already exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could look at something and our kids are watching a commercial and they want to buy a product. Well, what if you take that to the next level and, you know, you can control people's views on everything from, you know, abortion to, you know, third world war. So that's what I worry about most. It's just, how do we, you know, we got to do this for the right reasons. This technology needs to see the light of day for the right reasons, to help people and give them a better quality of life. But there are things that we'll never see. You know, I talked to a researcher not long ago about, you know, the fact that there's, you know, automobile tires, rubber on the tires. They have a composite that you'll never have to, it'll never wear out. But how often do we replace our tires on our automobiles? You've heard about the pill that turns water into gasoline or petrol. So, you know, those things are bought out, put in a bottom drawer somewhere and used for their own purposes at, you know, corporate or government levels. That's what I, you know, it's sort of a, I don't want to get over paranoid about it, but
that's, No. I agree with you. Proceed.
So that's what I think about.
Most. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, sure. And the question is if there's any way out of that situation of preventing someone from using it in a, you know, quote unquote bad way, or a way we don't agree with, or, you know, another person don't agree with. I mean, with fire, you can, you know, heat yourself, or, you know, cook your meat, or you can burn down your house. I mean, there's no way of preventing that. We can't put a law on fire. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's right. No, I don't have, you're right, but I don't have an answer to that. You're absolutely right. You know, there's not enough James Bond 007s running around to help do the right thing.
Yeah. Wow. No, it's, I think with potential and with the, you know, great advancements, there will always be that, danger and possibility of it being used in such a way. I don't think there is, I mean, there's some people who are, instead than Luddites, if you will, they want to actually go back in the other way. We were talking, you know, the Unabomber, like all technology is evil and bad, and it has to go. Otherwise, we will ultimately destroy ourselves. You know, so yeah. There's all kinds of opinions out there.
Well, just, you know, I keep hearing more and more about and look what our social media and internet's doing to our children. So there's a lot of questions about how fast and, you know, this technology even should move. It's scary, really scary. But, you know, you bring up some great point. There's something else out there. I think there's some fundamental issues that we probably need to get back to fundamentals with, is just things like, you know, and I hate to come back to that, but abortion, you know, the right and wrong, and when does life begin? And, you know, we debate that issue while at the same time we're marching off to war to try to wipe out, you know, a whole society. And there's genocide occurring. And then we come back and we debate euthanasia. You know, a person that is suffering and dying at an elderly age, it can't control, it has no brain function that we can't assist them to leave this world. And we're still struggling with that. So there's big extremes on you know, these moral and ethical issues that I think we'll probably never resolve in our lifetime. But then you sort of marry that with this technology issue. We have a lot to think about and worry about.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rudy, when it comes to the usage of this technology, the usage by governments, etc. And as we said, I think it's ultimately about people who are living, who has to be, if you will, vigilant about these technologies, you know, not allowing governments who are unfit, if you will, for these types of technologies to take them over or to them, you know, claim them for themselves, basically. I have always believed that it's awareness and information that is going to aid and help this, so people know what is happening to them in their own country, in their own city, what maybe companies are doing around them, etc., so that they can be basically aware of who they're supporting and for what reason, so that they can be aware that it's not being used for any of these purposes that we've been talking about that raises concern, basically.
Right. No, it all starts at the personal level. I mean, if I think back on all these technologies I've just described to you as well, it starts with someone innovating in a lab. It starts with an individual. And even in Equity of Evil, the first book, it talks about how, you know, Roman, he makes some bad decisions. But it later on, though, he realizes his mistakes. It's really humanizing for him. At one point, because he's dealing flippantly almost from a business perspective on issues like abortion and, you know, sex trade and human trafficking.
Yeah.
And he's embarrassed to be a man because he did not have an appreciation for sort of the woman's side of it. If he made some different decisions, this whole thing wouldn't have evolved. So I think there's a way, and I don't, you know, but scientists are scientists, and innovators are innovators, and businessmen are there for a reason. You know, how do we make them step back and think about the consequences of their actions? And it comes down to the human element.
Absolutely. Earlier you mentioned that there are, you know, other scary medical examples. Are there a few more of these that we can talk through or go over briefly?
Maybe for the next segment that'd be a good one to pursue. I'd have to give some thought on, you know, a little more detail, because again, some of them are under sort of confidentiality. The reason I was able to talk about this, you know, back in, from something that happened back in the 70s, that sort of time elapsed. I was under a gag order basically back then not to talk about it, even, you know, in the 70s when things were a little more open. So, but there's some things that I'm aware of that are under development, that might be a breach of confidentiality. So I got to give that some thought. Maybe for the next segment we can do that.
All right. Well, that's good. We could always, you know, revisit this and talk more about it at a later stage as well. Rudy, I think it's a good time to wrap things up here for this time, Dem. I wanted to ask you more, of course, about your website, about where people can go to pick up copies of the book and read more about them if they're interested. And begin with your website, please.
Very good. Yeah, it's there's two URLs that you can get to it from. One is simply my name. It's www.rudymazzocchi. It's RudyMazzocchi.com. Also, equityofevil.com. And there's a blog site that you can find through my website. And the books are available now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get them in ebook or print version. My publisher is Twilight Times Books, and they have their own website. So not to the bookstores yet, but you know, it's an interesting new industry that I've learned as well, and interesting. It's another even just a topic to discuss at some other show. But how ebooks, electronic books now are outselling probably 8-to-1 print.
Yeah.
So it's all becoming electronic. So that, you know, and even our sales in these books are you know, heavily weighted towards electronic books or ebooks. So I think that'll do. You can find, again, there's a synopsis and ways of contacting me on my website.
Excellent. We're going to have the links up on redicecreations.com as well. I want to thank you for your time today, Rudy. We appreciate it. It's interesting to hear about this field and, of course, an industry that we don't hear so much about. So it's interesting getting a little glimpse into it, see what happened in the past and where we potentially is going in the future. So thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
That's our program for today. We have a lot more coming up. Next is Matt Presti and Robert Otey on Walter and Leo Russell. Then Ian Crane is back to talk about fracking. After this, we have Kevin Barrett, Graham Hancock, and Dean Clifford, to name a few. I hope you have a good rest of your day or evening, and that you check out our website for more radio, news, videos, and all the social links as well. Have a good one, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.